Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Deer hunting season is wrapped up in the north zone of Texas and continues till January 19th in the south zone. For many rural areas in the state, deer season is an economic boost. Deer hunting adds an estimated $4.6 billion to the state's economy and supports about 24,000 jobs. That's according to Texas A&M's Natural Resources Institute. State wildlife officials have predicted that this would be one of the best hunting seasons in a while. Over 700,000 people in Texas hunt deer. And while others may think that the practice is unnecessary and cruel, it does allow deer to flourish in the state. And this disconnect is part of the nature of deer. They are creatures of contradictions. They seem domesticated, but yet, yeah, they're wild. They have value, but they are a nuisance. Erica Hauser writes about that. She's the author of the book, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. And Erica, welcome to The Source.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. And we do want to hear folks' deer stories. What stories do you have about a deer? Do you have a particularly friendly deer that you have struck up a kinship with? Are you a deer hunter? Do you have, how do you see the deer? Tell me about if your level of respect and honor that you have for the deer as you hunt it. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Or do you understand the mythology of deer and you relate to that? We want to hear that story as well. 833-TPR-TALK, and you can text us at that call-in number, 833-877-8255. Erica, what is your first deer memory?
Well, so I grew up in southwestern Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh, and one thing that that region shares with Texas is that there is a pretty strong deer hunting culture there. And my parents were not hunters, but I knew a lot of people who were hunters. So some folks in my extended family and family friends, and, you know, just teachers at school, other kids at school, it was, deer hunting was something that I heard people talking about often. It was kind of in the air when I was growing up. And so the first memory that I can identify that involves a deer is a deer hunting memory. And that is, I describe it in the book, I'm standing in the yard of my friend's house and her dad and another man are bringing a deer out of the woods that they've just hunted. So, of course, it's fall and it's, you know, probably very gray and chilly. And seeing these guys come out of the woods with a fresh deer, I think I was probably 7 or 8, something like that. And that really stuck with me and made an impression on me.
And so did you feel compassion for the deer? Were you horrified? Was this a traumatic experience?
I don't think it was traumatic. I don't think I was horrified, but I do, it's not a happy memory either. You know, I think there was something to me kind of dark about it. And as I say in the book, it was a little bit wrapped up with this friend's father himself, who was kind of a dark figure, and the early connections that I was making in my brain with hunting through him were that I was a bit put off by the whole thing. And so it's been a really interesting journey in writing this book to kind of take a fresh look, you know, as an adult at deer hunting and see what it looks and feels like to me now.
So what conclusion do you have? I mean, this is not an anti-deer hunting book. There are people who are very much against deer hunting, but then, I mean, what do you walk away with?
Well, it's a really complex mix of things that I walk away with. My primary avenue into the world of deer hunting has been my brother, who's younger than me, and he learned to hunt when he was a teenager. I was already out of the house at that time. I was away at college, so I wasn't very tuned into this, but when he was about 14, one of our uncles and our cousin taught my brother how to hunt deer. And so he kept at it over the years. He's become very good at it. And so when I was writing the book, I asked him to let me tag along. And so he let me come along with him on first a bow hunt when it was just the two of us. But then probably the more significant thing is that we both went to where that same uncle and cousin live in Pennsylvania and took part in this group kind of communal cooperative hunt that they've been doing for many years in that spot. My brother's been part of it for a long time. And they hunt together as a group. And one of the things that I learned from that was that, I just got a window into this thing that happens in my family every year at the same time. It's really kind of an important family ritual, I realized. And I was just very amazed by the amount of meat that they were able to procure by doing that. They do hunt cooperatively, and it's a pretty efficient method. So the first time I went there to observe this, I believe they harvested 8 deer in a day. And this was a group of about 10 or 12 people. So it's really efficient. It's a high success rate, and they're doing it to get meat, and they're good at it. And I just looked at all that meat at the end of the day and thought, this is all meat that doesn't need to be bought from a grocery store. It probably would be, purchased beef otherwise if they weren't doing this deer hunting. And, knowing what we know about the way supermarket beef is raised, I've got to say, venison that comes from the land that's right outside your house, it's by definition, it's organic and free range. I think that's a pretty good thing. So I've actually gone back a couple more times to participate in that with them. I'm still not a hunter, but I'm an observer, and I go along and just to be kind of part of the group and part of that experience with them.
Well, we're coming up against this break, so I don't want to give you a question right now. But when we come back, I do want to kind of link the experience from your younger brother with a group going out hunting. They don't have to do that. You got to wonder if you calculated all the expense and the licenses and everything else you got to deal with, if it's actually cheaper than buying, meat at the store. But maybe it's necessary but unnecessary, because it connects to our human roots. Hunting as a group, a tribal activity, just being outside, and the connection to the deer, the deer being a universal animal. We're going to talk about that and its connection to humanity's, maturation and becoming the dominant species on the planet. We're closely aligned. We're kins. People say the deer is our brother. We'll talk about that when we come back from the break. We do want to hear folks' deer stories. How do you feel about the deer? How do you relate to the deer? Do you feel like you have a special spiritual connection to the deer? Or do you think of it as something that we need to protect? Let's have a conversation. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Barbara is on the board, and Barbara, we're going to put you on the air when we come back from this quick break. Stay with us. This is The Source.
The City of San Antonio Revitalized SA Corridor Leadership Program offers no-cost training for those interested in neighborhood commercial corridor revitalization. Over 9 months, participants will obtain leadership and strategy skills and have an opportunity for grant funding. Applications at sanantonio.gov/edd/revitalizeSA. This nonprofit message is underwritten by the Economic Development Department.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. We're joined by the author, Erica Hauser. You can call in with your questions, comments, and deer stories. You want to hear about your connection to the deer, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Barbara on the phones. And Barbara, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me, and Happy New Year, first of all. And thank you so much for having other topics than politics. It's so refreshing, you know. I mean, talking about deer, music, whatever. It's so awesome. And in regards, so thank you for that.
Thank you.
In regards to the deer, just the story I have, you know, I grew up in Germany, and, you know, I was blessed to be able, as a kid even, to sometimes just wander around alone in the woods. Imagine that. I'm 60, so it's been a while back. And, you know, I would come like to a clearing or something, and would see a deer, and the awe that inspired of seeing, in a way, especially as a child, such a majestic animal. And, you know, they never did me any harm, and I never did them any harm. And, you know, I'm a vegetarian, but I can also understand and respect, like how, you know, native cultures have supplied, you know, food to themselves. And anyway, I just really think it's great. We have different topics and different views on that. And so thank you.
Well, Barbara, thank you for the call. Erica, can you kind of talk about, you know, it's very visual, the description we got there. We could almost see it in our mind's eye, what she was talking about. And how does that, you know, reflect on our group vision of deer?
Yeah, it is very visual. And I think maybe the reason is because we have seen so many visual depictions of that moment that she's describing, because it's an iconic experience, right, to wander in the woods. I love hearing about somebody's childhood, you know, happening in the forest. That's just wonderful. And how lucky and amazing, really, to be able to come across such a large, charismatic creature that, as she said, you don't need to be afraid of. You can just have this kind of pure appreciation of that moment of communion with another being. And the way a deer will stop and look back at us is something that's just, you know, very, very striking. And we are predators of deer, and that accounts for a lot of our interest in them historically. I think they're just such important food animals and providers of hides and bones and other materials that people have been using for millennia. But they also just have, obviously, this beauty and, as she said, majesty. So if you look through art history, you'll just find deer everywhere, and lots of images that are kind of akin to what the caller described. And so I think that that does really speak to part of our kind of cultural intertwining with them, that we have not only in visual arts, but in, you know, poetry and literature, just they show up a lot, and they're iconic, and their outline is just a really familiar form that has meant a lot to humans over time, going all the way back to cave art. So
right, talk about that. So the cave art that we have in Europe, but also in the West Texas, you know, cave art, the early art before, you know, the settlements here in the United States, you know, going back thousands of years, there's art there, painted rock of deer.
Mm. You know, I didn't actually know about that. That's wonderful. I know that there are lots of, you know, big hoofed mammals in depicted in different art sites throughout the Southwest, but I didn't specifically know about that in West Texas. So that's exciting. In terms of the European cave art sites, you know, the biggest cave art galleries like Lascaux and Altamira in France and Spain. What I've read is that deer are one of the four most frequently depicted subjects in those caves. So I think that really speaks to what their importance has been to humanity for tens of thousands of years.
Let's go to the caller. Our number is 833-877-8255. If you want to share your deer story, we want to hear it. Let's go to Freddie. And Freddie, you're on the air.
Yes, go ahead. You want me to tell you about myself?
Yeah, Freddie, tell me about your deer.
Well, I grew up in South Texas in San Antonio and in the area. I'm a rancher on the southwest border. And deer hunting, deer culture has been very much a part of my life and my family's life for several generations. And it's still a very important part of life in Texas and a lot for a lot of people.
And you raise deer, or, I mean, how do you tend to deer, or do deer management?
We do deer management. I have a ranch, and the ranch has the numbers of deer on it, wild deer, white-tailed deer. And so we have managed to keep the numbers right, everything right, protect them. And we hunt them, and we do it in a manner that enhances the deer herd every chance we get.
All right, Freddie, thank you for calling in and helping us understand a little bit better about, you know, the deer situation in Texas and your connection to that. That was great. Appreciate it. Erica, so the deer in Texas are owned by the people of Texas. They are part of the commons. Is that common?
Yes, it is common. Ever since about the turn of the 20th century, when the conservation movement really kind of came into being in this country, the deer population and many other wildlife populations were at a real low around that time because of a few centuries of overhunting and habitat loss. And so one of the big accomplishments of the conservation movement was to define wildlife as belonging to the public and held in trust for the public by the state. So this is where you see the establishment of state wildlife agencies who kind of oversee state deer populations and regulate hunting in those states. And that's all, you know, with the goal, as the caller said, of keeping the population going into the future so that the sport of hunting can continue, and so that, you know, we all have deer to enjoy, whether we're hunters or not.
Let's go to another caller, Gary. And Gary, you're on the air.
David, good afternoon. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you for calling in, Gary.
Yeah, sure, buddy. I just wanted to share with your guest, the cosmology here in Texas is based entirely on the deer and the hunt. And so every year our people gather in San Angelo to see the sunrise. And then following that sunrise, there's a solar dart that appears in Paint Rock, Texas, that pierces the heart of the deer. And it's a yearly thing that we go to celebrate this sacrifice that the deer makes solely on its own for the sake of the people of Texas and northwestern Mexico. Just wanted to say that.
Right. And so can you tell us, like, you know, you are, you know, part of the native people's population of Texas. So you have
right.
that connection.
Right. I'm the cultural preservation officer for the Pacawan peoples of Coahuila, Itaja.
Gary, thank you for calling in and reminding us about that story. So, Erica, it's an ancient, goes back thousands of years. It's called the Heart of the Deer, and it's painted on the Paint Rock in Texas. And once a year, the sun hits it just right so that there's a dagger that goes of light that goes through that icon, and it is as Gary described it.
Yeah, I'm so happy that Gary called in and shared that. That's a really fascinating cosmology and ritual that is being described. And it certainly sounds like it could be similar in certain ways to other native rituals around deer. And I appreciate what he mentioned about this idea that the deer is, I think he said this, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but that the deer is offering itself to the people as a way of sustaining human life. And that's such a common thread throughout many of these rituals and stories that are told. And it's something that really, really fascinates me, this kind of notion that, you know, in mythological time and space, that there's kind of an agreement between humans and deer, that the deer will give their lives to sustain our lives and really give themselves to us as a gift. And that's a perspective that I really, really impacted me a lot when I was researching the book, and that I really love and respect.
Right. And what the deer is asking for in return is respect.
Exactly. And there are, you know, so many traditional hunting cultures where the act of hunting is to be followed by an act of kind of atonement, or at least, you know, gratitude, certainly offering thanks and respect for this gift of a deer's life.
The caller, Suzanne, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I want to share the experience I had while I was living in France, and I witnessed the chasseur corps. So we're a group of riders. They have many, many dogs. And the night before, the forester goes and he finds the deer, right? And then the next morning, they make the music and the singing, and then the dogs get loose and they chase, they try to rally the deer. Eventually, the deer starts running, and you see him running. And then the deer tries to go into the water to get away from the dog. Some of the dogs get totally lost. Some find the groups is divided. Eventually, after 5 or 6 hours, the deer, they find the deer. And it was, I remember to this day, it's a clearing, and the deer stood in the middle of the clearing, and he could not move anymore. He just stood there. The dogs are all around barking at him, but they are very trained. They did not attack the dog. Then one of the riders is appointed to go and do the rescue. He gets up. He walks down there. The deer does not move. He just stands. And he takes his big knife out and plunges it into his heart, and the deer falls down. And then they have a butcher. Then they have this celebration of having the deer, you know. And then in the end, the butcher comes and he takes the deer apart, and it is done with such masterful, it looks like child play. Anybody who is very good at doing something, it looks easy. And then everything is given to people that distinguish themselves during the hunt, the hoofs, the heart, the ears, you know. And in the end, the dogs get the rest, and then they become really wild and, you know, fight over what is left. But that was an incredible experience. They always say, well, the, you know, Americans, they feed the deer and then they go shoot them. In France, the deer has a chance. I don't really know how the deer has a chance. They chase him for 5-6 hours, but that was my experience. So,
all right, Suzanne, appreciate that. That's a quite the stirring story. Appreciate you calling in with that. Erica, your response?
Well, it is very stirring, and it reminds me in some ways of the, you know, the hunting rituals in Europe that go back a long way. I'm thinking of, you know, the medieval deer parks that were established in France, and also quite a few in England, where the hunting was done with dogs, and there would be a...
Well, this is for the nobles.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The hunts were kind of ritualistic ways for the nobility to show their power and their wealth, because they were the only ones who were allowed to hunt deer. And it involved dogs and a lot of pomp and circumstance, and you know, the noble killing the deer was the sort of climactic moment that would prove that he was the one who had the wealth and power to be able to do that, whereas ordinary people were not allowed to hunt deer.
Which is the status of the deer hunt, which reminds me of like why some people have those deer heads mounted in their homes. It's a show of status. So we can talk more about deer, our culture, our connection When we come back from the break, the book is The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. This is The Source. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about deer. The author of the book, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors, is Erica Hauser, and she joins us, and she's here to hear your stories, take your calls, answer your questions about deer and our connection to this large mammal. You can call in. The number is 833-877-8255. 833-TPR-TALK. So, Erica, you write about deer in mythology. Frequently, deer are shown in myths as messengers, symbols of, trying to communicate to us from the unknown. What's all that?
Well, that is a really common theme in myths about deer, that deer will kind of appear to somebody, usually to a hunter, and in the process of following that deer, tracking the deer, that person will be led to a new place or some new understanding or some new identity for themselves. I'm thinking of a story about a Welsh saint who followed a deer to a new spot where he ended up founding a monastery. So that's one example. And there are other Christian saints and lots of other figures from various cultures. And I love that kind of theme or that motif, because it seems so true to the nature of deer that they do sort of lead you on further and further. You know, that you run after them, they turn around and stop and look at you. And maybe most of us have seen deer do that. When they turn and look at you that way, you feel as though you might have a chance of catching up. So then you keep going and they just keep leading you on and on. That does play out in a lot of stories from around the world.
Yeah, they seem like they know something. You know, they know they have a secret, and they know maybe they'll share it with you.
Yeah, I think that's part of their charisma. And of course, just their athleticism has always impressed humans, the way they're able to run, and they're such good jumpers. And also, I think that there's something very important about the fact that deer are a similar size to people. Clearly, they have a pretty different, you know, form than we do, but they're not dissimilar to us in size. And I think that has allowed us to see ourselves in them in certain ways. And there are a lot of other stories about deer and humans becoming each other and kind of shape-shifting into each other. And so there is this kind of deep kinship and similarity that's being expressed in all these stories.
We have a problem, though, with deer in suburban neighborhoods. Typically, they're almost like, who's the invader? Are we the invader? Are they the invader? Whose space is it? What is happening when we have humans and deer interacting? Not on as a hunter and prey situation, but just as cohabitating in these neighborhoods.
Right, and that's why I use the word neighbors in the subtitle of my book, because we do live with them like neighbors in many places, and just like our human neighbors, you know, we're glad to have neighbors, but sometimes we get on each other's nerves or get in each other's way, and that's certainly the case with deer. You know, the thing with deer, especially white-tailed deer, is that they're just really brilliant at adaptation. So they've been able to figure out how to live very well in these kind of dense human spaces, even though we associate them with wilderness and kind of, you know, unbroken forest, untouched wilderness. They actually do really well in the suburbs because there's plenty of food and there's plenty of cover for them, and there's typically little or no hunting. So, you know, cars are a danger, but they are able to do really well for the most part in human spaces, and it does cause conflict.
And you say cars, you know, we know about the collisions that happen. There's a time of year when deer are more likely to be on the highways? What do you know?
Yeah, so fall is, and many people probably know this from experience, unfortunately, but fall is the busiest time for deer vehicle collisions, and that's because that's the rut for deer. So both males and females at that time of year are just moving around a lot more, and so they end up crossing more roads. I think nationwide, November is the worst month for collisions with deer, and October and December are kind of close behind that. So that whole last period of the year is rough as far as that goes.
Now, you've heard the expression deer in the headlights. What is happening there? Why doesn't the deer get out of the way?
Well, quite simply because they haven't evolved to understand that anything could move as fast as a car can move. That's a type of predator that they have not evolved to deal with. So it's not really fair to expect them to understand what's going on when an object moves at 45 or 65 or 85 miles an hour. It's just not something that they're equipped to deal with. I mean, having said that, I've been told by a number of people in different places around the country, oh, the deer in our town are so well adapted that when they cross the street, they look both ways. I've heard people say that several times. So I think they're, you know, again, they're very good at adaptation. It's just that they have not yet figured out that if they're standing in the road and a car is coming, they should move.
Now the caller, and the number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK for you to join the conversation. Let's go to Lily. And hi, Lily, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for this conversation. I love the history, and I have, as a military spouse, lived all over the country, had different kind of deer in Ohio, in Colorado, of course, and now here in Texas. My concern is that I'm in the outlying areas of San Antonio, where we do have quite a few deer, but the growth of our communities has really infringed on their environment. And we have tried to work with state officials to kind of help manage that herd. The herd continues to grow, but my biggest concern has to be with people. We as residents often turn them into yard pets and feed them corn and donuts and gross things, bread and things that are not healthy for them. And we noted that pretty quickly that our herd was not looking as healthy as it should. And so as much as I'm not a hunter, I understand hunting is an important aspect. And some of the hunters I found were the best conservationists when it comes to managing a herd of deer. We have tried different ways of removing deer from our community to other ranches for hunting, to using the meat for food for agencies that could serve more, you know, the population in need. And so there's a mixed message going on here with our deer, with this honored past that they've had and how we treat them today. And that is pretty much right. My comment.
Well, you bring up some great points, Lily. We're going to dig into that. I do want to mention first off that the San Antonio South Texas Food Bank does accept donations of deer venison from hunters who got more than they can use, and they can donate it to the food bank, and they will process it, and they will use it to deal with people who are food insecure locally. But can you talk about the other part of Lily's call, Erica?
Yeah, she raised so many important points, and it sounds like the community that she lives in is experiencing issues that many, many communities in all kinds of places around the country deal with, you know, from New Jersey to small towns in the northern Rockies to California, you know, and where you all are in Texas. So it's a common story when a human community grows and meanwhile there's a deer population that's dense and perhaps getting more so in that same place. And it sounds like her community has tried some different strategies. She didn't exactly say this, but I'm gathering that they've tried some form of culling, which many communities do. And she's right. That is
a, and it's controversial.
It's very controversial, and it is a real contradiction, as she said, with this kind of historical reciprocity and regard that we've had for deer. I investigated some culling that has been conducted for a long time in Princeton, New Jersey. Went there and observed that and talked with folks about it.
And how do they do it?
Well, they hire a nonprofit called White Buffalo Inc. To come in for several weeks every winter time, I think in February. So their call is probably coming up here soon. And they do it in two ways. They use sharpshooters who sit in tree stands, and the deer are baited. So they come to a pile of corn and sharpshooters kill them from tree stands. The other method they use is with big nets. So they'll put bait under these large nets. They almost look like those wedding tents that people put up with kind of multiple poles, but they can be dropped onto the deer very quickly. So once you have a number of deer under a net, you can drop the net down and then go in and kill them with bolt guns. So, you know,
I mean, but that's what, I mean, it's, that's the controversy. It sounds brutal. It sounds rough, but we know that needs to be done. This is part of what we have to figure out. This is what we have to come to terms with. It's not easy, but yeah, let's do that. We're going to take a break. Let's talk about this a little bit more. I mean, this is what has to happen in order to have a healthy deer population. Erica Hauser, she is the author of The Age of Deer, Trouble in Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Our guest is Erica Hauser. Her book is The Age of Deer, Trouble in Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. She writes about the mythology, the long history. As long as humans have been around, there have been deer. Deers have presented themselves as, you know, they're something that we can hunt and we can feed on, and it's allowed humanity to flourish. But what is our relationship with deer now, particularly as our settlements, our homes, our communities have grown and we've gotten a little kind of friendly with deer? Is that something that actually works? So you can call in 833-877-8255. Let's go to Ken on the phones. And Ken, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest is, I live just on the outskirts of a major metropolitan city in Texas, and my neighborhood butts up to a huge preserve that's preserved the recharge area of an aquifer, and there's, of course, a lot of wild deer still around, and on occasion, I'll buy mineral blocks for these deer, but earlier this week, I was out at the store going to purchase one, and the packaging said they were habit forming. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Should I not be providing these mineral blocks for these wild deer? So that's the question I had.
Is it habit forming for you or for the deer?
It said for the deer.
I'm kidding.
Yeah.
All right, Ken, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Eric, do you know what he's talking about? Erica?
Yeah, I think, you know, this would be basically considered a form of feeding deer, although it's, you know, providing salt essentially, rather than corn or something like that. But most wildlife biologists, if you ask them this question, and I'm not a wildlife biologist, but I think most of them would say it's best not to provide any kind of food or nutrition to wild deer. It is, you know, it's funny that you say, is it habit forming for the human or for the deer? I think it is a bit habit forming for humans to feed deer because people just get a bit attached to these animals, and they really enjoy kind of thinking of themselves as helpers and friends to wildlife. And that's a lovely urge. But it's, I think, one reason that wildlife officials would probably advise to not do that, and why it is actually prohibited in a lot of places. One of the, there are several reasons for that, but one of them that is important to me is that there are diseases that can be spread when deer are kind of sharing food very closely like that. You know, if multiple deer kind of have their heads down in the same spot feeding, and one of the worst diseases that can be spread that way is chronic wasting disease, which we haven't talked about yet, but it's a major issue for deer in North America, and thus for deer hunters and all of us who care about deer. And it can be spread through saliva. So the feeding of deer is problematic, at least in that way, for sure.
That's like wild, like mad cow disease, right?
Yes, it's closely related to mad cow disease. It's caused by not a bacteria and not a virus, but by something called a prion, which is a misfolded protein, which can be transmitted deer to deer, but the prions can also be shed by a sick animal into the soil and can stay in the soil for, I think, about a decade, and then can reinfect, you know, a different animal from that soil or from plants even that are growing in that soil. So it's a real problem. There's no treatment or cure, and it is spreading very steadily around the U.S.
Let's go to another caller, Beverly. And Beverly, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I love the deer. I live out in the country, and they're always out here looking at me, and I'm looking at them. I have a question. What, when the males shed their antlers, or what is going on when they get the red, which looks like blood, on there? I had an experience once where, completely out of the blue, a buck came flying past me and ran and jumped straight into a body of water that I was next to, and was jumping and shaking his head. And I thought, wow, he is really distressed there. So what was going on? And I saw very clearly the red blood, or what is that on his antlers? What was going on?
Beverly, thank you for that call. And so, Erica.
Well, I'm not an expert on this, but I think that when the antlers are shed, which happens roughly this time of year, it's kind of like losing a tooth. You know, there's that kind of raw gap there, and it does heal up. And I cannot explain the behavior of this buck that you saw, but I think that there's probably some sensation, you know, again, like when a person loses a tooth, that might be uncomfortable. So you said he was shaking his head. My guess, and I'm not a scientist, I don't know, but my guess would be maybe that was just a kind of uncomfortable or maybe even itchy sensation, and he was just sort of reacting to that.
For the caller, Jenny, and Jenny, you're on the air.
Hi, I was calling because I wanted your listeners to hear this little tip that I'm pretty sure I heard on NPR at some point, that when it comes to collisions with vehicles, that they can see the horizontal solid light strip that people affix to the front of their vehicles, that deer can perceive that is approaching them because it steadily, you know, increases in size, as opposed to two headlights. And so I just wanted, if listeners maybe that live out in the country, or even, you know, the outskirts of San Antonio that happen to see deer, if you get one of those strips, especially on the bigger trucks, they can see that better. I'm pretty sure I heard that on NPR. I just wanted to pass that on.
Oh, wow. Jenny, thank you for that. What about those, like, whistle things that you attach to the front of your car that could deter deer, they say? Does that work?
Well, unfortunately, I have read that the whistles have been studied and have not found to be effective. The strips sound like a really inexpensive thing to try, though, and certainly couldn't hurt to give it a try.
Okay, now I'll go to Donnie. And Donnie, you're on the air.
Okay, yes. Talking about a deer being smart, I was remembering in, as a young man with my grandfather, like I say, we as a ranch, you know, we was rounding up cattle or sheep and right after deer season, you know, and of course my grandfather, no hunting allowed anyway, and low fences, you know, and deer were pretty free to roam, and boy, you'd see a big one, and my grandpa would say, boy, that's a smart one, he's hiding out, he's tired, but he'll get back going, you know, when the hunters leave. But anyway, that's that. You know, we just always said the smart ones, you know, grow old and get big horns. The next thing, of course, many states, you're not allowed to feed the deer. But, of course, in Texas, well, there you go. They don't, you know, feeding corn. And, you know, you feed a lot of wild hogs, they're eating it, and raccoons, skunks. You're just feeding everything. I'm pro wildlife, and the wilder the better.
All right, Donnie, thank you for your call. I appreciate that. And so, feeding the deer, a bad idea all around, according to Donnie.
Yeah, you know, I'm sympathetic to his viewpoint, the wilder the better. I think that's probably, if we're going to err on the side of one way or the other, that makes sense to me. Trust that they can find food. They're very, very good at it.
Food and water. I'm concerned about the drought situations that we have here in Texas, you know. And where do they go? I mean, you know, it's when things are nice, you see the deer roaming around. But when the weather's harsh, they just what? They just bunk down?
Yeah, they hunker down. You know, right now I live in Virginia and we've got snow on the ground right now. And we were thinking about that the other day as the snow was coming down. You know, wonder what they're doing. How are they weathering the storm? And they always seem to be able to do it. They have, you know, this kind of genius for finding the right place to bed down where the sun will hit it at just the right angle, you know, to keep them a few degrees warmer. They've had millions of years to adapt to life on this continent, and they're really good at being here.
So what does the future of the deer look like? Clearly, we're not going to hunt them into extinction, but they're, like you talked about, with the chronic wasting disease and the eradication of their habitat, where are they going to, what does it look like for them?
Yeah, it's a mixed picture. You know, there are so many things changing quickly in our environment overall. A chronic wasting disease is very concerning. I followed some scientists who were doing a big study about that in Arkansas, and I was talking with the lead scientist of Future of Deer, and I said, you know, do you think this disease could actually cause the extinction of deer? And he actually did not rule it out, which kind of shocked me, but he said that's one of a range of things that could happen, of possible outcomes. And, you know, maybe it'll be that deer don't live as long anymore, because chronic wasting disease will kill a deer within about 2 years. So if it's really endemic in a population and most of the fawns are contracting it, you know, early in life, then they won't have the chance to, as Donnie was talking about, you know, get old and wise and become really big bucks or big does. They'll die younger. So that's a sad picture.
One thing about talking about deer is that once you get them on the brain, you're going to see them all over the place. That's going to be a fun part of the story. Erica Hauser is the author of The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. Such a great conversation, Erica. Very fun. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.